One. In other words, are you familiar with this antenna, Dick? It's been highlighted a number of times in the ARRL antenna book. Over.
Yes, I am. The four-element quad is a fairly popular antenna. When it's built at HF frequencies, quite often the spider mechanism that supports the wire is made out of either bamboo poles or fiberglass poles. There's also a variation of this called the quad Yagi, where the reflector and driven element are cubical quad and the rest of the elements are ordinary dipole-like directors. Most likely you're talking about the true four-element quad, and I am familiar with that one. Go right ahead, Mel, with the rest of your question.
Okay, this is the one for that's actually called the portable. It was actually designed for portable use for field day operations, for taking it out in the field, you know, to improve your getting to a specific repeater at a certain distance. This is called the portable 144 megahertz four-element quad. Fact, I just dug out the book on it because, you know, I cruised over it a number of times, but didn't remember the idiosyncrasies of it. So are you familiar with that one, or do you want to see it in the book, Dick? Over.
I think I'm familiar enough with the way it works, the way it's set up, and the way you control its polarization. So go ahead and finish your question, and I've got a bunch of comments on this one. Go ahead.
Okay, question number one. Is it necessary to see the quad, the driven element of the quad, on one side rather than on the bottom for vertical polarization? Is that a factor? Over.
It certainly is. The actual driven element is what determines the polarization characteristics of your group of a quad. Each one of your elements are almost a pure rectangular, regular square. In other words, the vertical sides and the horizontal sides have got the exact same length. And depending on which design we're talking about, quite often the director number one and director number two are a little bit smaller than the driven element and the reflector. But the way you feed the driven element determines entirely your polarization. The rest of the antenna will follow. If you feed it across the bottom or across the top, the middle of the horizontal portion of the driven element cubical quad, feed it in the middle of the bottom horizontal piece, you are purely horizontally polarized. Feed it at the top, you're the same thing. Feed it along the vertically side, you are vertically polarized. Feed it at one of the diagonal corners, and you are 45 degrees slant polarized. So how you feed it determines the polarization, and there's almost no exception to that. If I insisted on feeding the transmission line into the bottom, but yet actually making the signal arrive along one of the vertical sides, because I'm snaking a piece of transmission line over there, with some fancy techniques, I could force vertical polarization even though I'm feeding it at the bottom. But it would be a very non-conventional technique. I don't recommend that. I know that mechanically it's more difficult to feed the vertical side, but if you really want vertical polarization, I think you've got to do that. What's your take on that one, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Exactly. Yeah, I also more or less agree with you in this particular situation that the way you feed it determines the whole operation of the antenna. Yeah, it is four elements, and yes, the two directors are somewhat reflect to be the bigger of the quad, the four-sided quad, and then tapering downward. Next question that they ask, does the boom have to be made of a non-metallic material? They are using wood here as the supports for the elements, and also a wooden boom. Is, well, I could see the element, but does the boom itself have to also be made of wood, Dick? Over.
I say absolutely not. If you want the highest possible strength to weight ratio for the drum, for the boom, in my opinion, you're going to make it out of aluminum tubing. Because the boom goes down the geometric center of the antenna, it is at the neutral plane, whether you're horizontal, vertical, slant, 45, no matter what. The boom is at the neutral plane of each of those elements. It picks up essentially zero signal and whether you make it out of a conductor or out of an insulator is strictly your choice of the materials that you use. But now the support structures, the X, so to speak, the spider as it's called, that actually holds up the piece of wire. Let me drop. A cubicle quad is a popular antenna because it has very low wind load. When you take it apart, it's got very little material to it. It's a real skeleton structure. That's the good news, but you've got to support these pieces of wire that are the actual elements and the driven element with this X-shaped insulator. The spider, the X-shaped insulator that supports the wire in the four corners, that really has to be an insulator. Oh, I guess there's a couple of exceptions where if you insist on that being metallic and you're willing to build choking mechanisms in the right spot, you could force that, but I don't recommend that. That really is insulated material. And when it comes to a cubicle quad that's not being used in a portable scenario, where you're setting up one on the top of the chimney or the top of the tower for permanent installation, you have to accept the fact that in between the X-shaped insulated support structure for, say, the driven element, the pieces of wire are supported at the four corners, but they're unsupported in the center, the normal method of construction. Let me drop. Therefore, when the wind blows, the metal is going to sing. It's going to move up and down or left and right, somewhat like like the string of a violin or of a guitar, so to speak. Therefore, the four corners, the wire is continuously going to be bent back and forth during the singing procedure when the wind blows, and therefore metal fatigue tends to happen. When you have a permanent installation of a cubicle quad, you have to worry about metal fatigue in the four corners. So any method that you can use that does strain relief at the four corners of each of the elements on a permanent installation, give that a lot of consideration. In a portable operation where it's going to be used for a day or two, you usually don't have to worry about that. These are some of my opinions about cubicle quad. It is a very light, very low wind load antenna. It gives you a lot of bang for the dollar, and it's relatively easy to homebrew. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, so that, let's clarify something. This does not use a spider. This uses wooden slats to support, because the elements, you know, at 2 meters are not that large. Actually, the director, about 77 inches of material. The reflector is about 86 inches of material. Driven element is about 81 inches of material, you know, into a square type configuration. So what they do is actually using pieces, strips of wood, and drilling holes, that the wire can just pass through, and using what kind of wire did they suggest? What kind of wire? I had to list something here, and let's see, aluminum wire. Aluminum wire that is available at the aluminum ground wire available at Radio Shack. Nick, what do you think of aluminum wire? Over.
The good news about aluminum wire is it's light, and maybe at Radio Shack for ground rods it's easily available. I don't like aluminum wire because it's extremely difficult to solder to, and when it comes to the fatigue problem of the element waving in the wind and the four corners being fatigue limited, I think you'd be way ahead of the game to use, let me pick a number, 14 gauge copper household wire and strip away the rubber insulation. So 14 gauge, 16 gauge, I would rather use copper wire. Easier to work with. The difference in weight is not that great. Easy to solder to. And by the way, the word spider, one method of making a two-element quad is for all of the insulated objects that support the four corners of the driven element and the four corners of the reflector, if it's a two-element quad, all of those are diagonal pieces of insulated material that come down to a common point on what you and I would call the boom. In the case of a four-element quad, I'm guessing from the boom you have X-shaped pieces of wooden slat, which are connected to the boom at right angles to each other, and then by holes or notches drilled at the edges, they support the lighter at the four corners. And so each one of those X-shaped devices of wooden slats are located along the boom at the appropriate position for reflector, driven element, director number one, and director number two. I think that's the method of construction you're describing, but I would be strongly influenced to use copper wire for the elements. I wonder how you feel about that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, they're just using single flats of wood. That is all. It's not an X type or anything like that. That's why I wanted you really to look at this construction. That's what I sort of questioned, that is this, you know, strong enough to hold together for any length of time. Okay, yeah, I sort of agree that, you know, copper wire, like number 12 or number 10 copper wire, I think number 10 copper wire would be a little bit better to give it a little bit more rigidity. And that's why I thought if you had one of the manuals, the antenna manuals handy, you could take a peek at it, because this has been repeated through many of the years of antenna manuals. Next, another question. Let me let it drop. Well, first, would you like to comment on that, on the construction, if you're familiar with this construction of just single plane construction, Dick, over?
Okay, now, the single plane construction is the wooden slat. You're saying it's not two slats at right angles that come out to the four corners of each individual element. You're saying it's one single slat of wood. Is there one single slat of wood for each individual element? In other words, it's a square of wood where the four corners of the wood sheet at right angles to the boom, is that what's supporting the four corners of, say, the driven element? Back to you, Mel.
Okay. Would you have any of the antenna handbook handy? This way, you know, as they say, one picture worth 1,000 words, Dick.
Okay. If you talk for 60 solid seconds, I'll pick up a handy talkie that I can walk around the house with. I'll hear what you're saying. At the same time, I'm going to get my antenna manual. Back to you, Mel. Take your time.
Okay, this is K2KEY. What we're discussing now, for some of the people here that may be interested in a very compact, portable antenna for 2 meters that you could take with you and set it up, you know, somewhere out in the field to see what repeaters you may be now able to hit with, even, say, your handy talkie. In other words, an improvement on just a simple you know, rubber ducky or whatever. Let me let it drop. Would be something like a portable 144 megahertz four-element quad. In fact, you could also build one. They also do have similar designs for the 70-centimeter band. So we're discussing now, you know, actually the nitty-gritty to put one together. It's very straightforward, and also I can say because of its compact and portability makes it a very effective, from what we can see, an effective antenna that does not require any specialized equipment to assemble, nor specialized material that can be obtained almost in any hardware place. So as soon as Dick gets the manual, let me take a break and see if he's back. We'll go further. Station checking in.
I just came back. I'm holding on to the 17th edition. What chapter, number, and page is this particular antenna, Mel? Go ahead.
Just have to pull the 18th edition. It's a portable 144 megahertz four-element quad. And in this, let's see, what is it? It's chapter 18. What do we call chapter 18? Yeah, I think it's portable antennas. Let's see, what's on the port? Chapter 18 here, Dick. I don't know, I think it's in the same chapter, over.
Chapter 18 is obviously portable antennas. What page number?
A VHF and UHF antenna system. This one is on page 1830, 18-30, over.
I see a portable 144 megaquad element quad, and sure enough, I see what's going on. The wire is so stiff that one vertical slat is holding on to the center of each element, and the rest of the element is unsupported. So the four corners are not supported. You're supporting the top and bottom horizontal piece. Very cute. Okay. I see the method of construction. I see it's Vizwar. I see there's a two-element quad on page 29. Page 30 is the four-element 144 meg portable quad. And I would prefer to make those elements out of copper. And because of the size of a two-element, I think anything bigger than 14-gauge would do it. 12-gauge and 10-gauge would be making it more beefy if you want to go that way. Over to you, Mel.
Hey, we did have somebody to check in. Let me take a stand. Let's take a standby and see who it possibly we may have missed before we go on. I'd hate to, you know, miss somebody that will give me a email and say, why don't you pick me up? So, Dick, pick up the station and then we'll continue.
Was there another person checking in with reference to the subject on the table right now, which is the portable four-element two-meter quad antenna out of the ARL antenna book? Is that what the person has some comment on? If so, give me your call letters and name at this time. Go right ahead, Mel, because as it is right now, I'm not quite sure we should be taking additional members' check-ins for later questions. We've got at least three people's questions to answer right after you and I finish right now. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, so I thought possibly they had a question on the subject, as you say, that's on the table right now. Okay, so now you're looking at the actual construction. If this was for permanent installation, would you then suggest a modification in the construction, in your opinion, Dick, over?
Yeah, I haven't read enough of the article to find out the four pieces of wooden slat, did they do anything to weatherproof it? Because the size is not very big, a more permanent material would probably be acrylic plastic or polycarbonate. Polycarbonate plastic, I think, is pretty good on ultraviolet exposure. So the four wooden slats, if that's what they are, I would be tempted to make them out of polycarbonate plastic or fiberglass. I'd be a little bit more careful on weatherproofing of the transmission line that goes to the feed point. But other than that, I suspect with reasonably good mechanical engineering on this thing, this could make a very nice permanent antenna, even though it's called portable. It wouldn't require a great deal of beefing up to make this thing be a permanent antenna. And on top of that, the price of the materials that goes into this antenna is such that if it destroyed itself in 8 years, and you have to replace it, I think you've more than got your money's worth. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, no doubt. I should say it's a for the buck, but they say the bang for the buck. All right, now, do you agree with the statement then that we can make the boom, say, out of a piece of, it's only 4 foot of boom, out of a piece of, say, television type of pipe or something, or, you know, light pipe or some sort, a piece of copper pipe or whatever. And now the question also is here, I have the question, the next question is, the vertical mast that joins to the boom, can that be made out of also a metallic material, or does that have to be insulated material, Dick, over?
Yeah, Don, good question. The boom can be made out of anything you like, conductive or non-conductive. Just choose a material that you think is going to survive the weather and be strong enough and light enough and cheap enough. Aluminum tubing would be my favorite. In the case of the vertical mast going through, a purist would tend to make that out of an insulated material, like a fiberglass piece of tubing. However, he's almost wasting his time to do that because he's still going to run a coaxial cable up the center of that mast. And the RF is still going to see a vertical metallic object coming up to the antenna. As such, I would use ordinary aluminum tubing for the vertical support mast, and only in the rare situation where that vertical piece of tubing happened to be a resonant length would it really do anything. If I went through the calculation, let me drop. If I went through the calculation of the effective capture area of this antenna when it's aimed at a source of signal, I don't know the exact numbers, but I'm going to guess it's going to be in the vicinity of 6 square feet of effective capture area, something like that. Your vertical piece of tubing maybe is going to be 1.5 inches, and in the vicinity of the antenna, it's going to cast a shadow of a very small fraction of 1 square foot. So as long as that vertical tubing is not a resonant length, its perturbation to the performance of the antenna is going to be extremely minor. It would take rather elaborately calibrated laboratory equipment to measure the slight difference of making that vertical mast out of fiberglass tubing versus aluminum tubing, particularly since, as I said, you're running up your coaxial cable through it. So for strength-to-weight reasons and longevity, I would make the vertical mast out of aluminum. I'd make the boom out of aluminum. I'd make the vertical slats out of something that I know would survive the weather. It could be wood with the right kind of weatherproofing on it, you know, some kind of good fiberglass paint, or making it out of polycarbonate plastic or fiberglass would do the job very nicely. So you and I would make some minor changes. We wouldn't use aluminum wire. We'd use copper wire. We'd make those changes. And I'll bet you the antenna, even in your salt spray environment near Manhattan Beach, I bet you this antenna would survive for more than 8 years. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Yeah, some of the last questions that I have here. One is, do you agree with the mathematics of determining the reflector, the driven element, and directors? Is that fairly, would you say, accurate enough to go by? In other words, can they more or less use the parameters that are laid out here with fairly decent results overall, Dick? Do you think it has to really be more experimenting? In other words, can you assemble the antenna directly from what you see here in the manual, in your opinion, over?
Yeah, I suspect that those formulas for a cubical quad antenna, reflector length is 1046.8 feet divided by F in megahertz and so on, a similar formula for driven element and director. They've been around for a long time, though. There's a lot of history of cubical quads. And a cubical quad, even a four-element one, is extremely forgiving. I suspect you could make quite a few percent of error on the size of those elements, and you'd get 95% of the performance. So that unless you're looking for the last 0.05 dB of improvement, I don't think when you play around with this antenna, you're going to find a whole lot of extra gain. But if you did want to, the way I would do it would be to set up a ratiometry antenna range. That's the one that was in 1978 QST magazine. I forget what month it was. I think it's the February issue. I think it's February 1978. If you're an ARRL member, you can go to the archives and read that article. The article is not as well written as I would like because it got edited in ways that are not quite reasonable to me. In other words, the complicated equation, which wasn't really needed, got left in. Some of the other useful information got edited out. So the article, I don't agree with the way the article got edited, but the concept of setting up two antennas side by side, one's a reference antenna, one's the antenna under test, going into a piece of test equipment that measures the difference between the two. It takes out the common mode. Let me drop. If on your antenna range, the transmitter that's downrange supplying the signal goes up and down in power output because Con Ed goes up and down in its voltage, or if the ground reflection changes because the ground is drying out, you started off early in the morning with a wet dew on the grass and it's drying out during the procedure, so your ground reflection magnitude is changing. All of those things are common mode changes to a ratiometry antenna range. The ratiometry antenna range is simply comparing the difference in signal strength between the two receiving antennas that are side by side. With that kind of an antenna range, you can now resolve easily 1/20th of a decibel, 0.05 decibel of improvement or detriment. You stand off to one side of this antenna with a long wooden stick with a small piece of copper tape on the end of the wooden stick. As you hold the copper tape near one of the sides of the cubicle quad, you're adding some extra capacitance that tunes it to a lower frequency. And you could watch whether or not the gain increases or decreases when you do that on the director, the driven element, the reflector. So it would tell you how to make a slight gain improvement if you wanted to. If you want that last little bit of performance, the average person doesn't need it. The guy you're talking to is never going to see it. Cubicle quads are very forgiving. Start off with this formula, build it that way, and then do this ratiometry antenna range improvement measurement if you want to. If you want to really find out the next level of accuracy of this five-digit number they gave you for calculating those lengths for your particular materials. So there's ways that you can tweak it under real working conditions and maximize its performance in ways that can resolve the difference by using that procedure. K2KEY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. And the final question is, what kind of performance do you feel that to get from this antenna, they would like to know, approximately, what kind of gain would you look for in an antenna like this? And would this be as good or better or equal to the same construction of four-element Yagi design in your estimate? Over.
The nice thing about this construction is that it, when taken apart in a certain way and folded flat, becomes a very low volumetric object that you're going to stuff into the trunk of a car, for instance, or into the back of a station wagon. There are methods of taking apart a four-element Yagi, which can also be extremely compact, maybe wing nuts on each of the individual elements, and they sit on saddles on top of the boom, and you either take them apart or swing them 90 degrees so that they're parallel to the boom and become very low in area. A guy named Wayne Oberbeck, K6YNB, Yankee November Bravo. Dr. Wayne Oberbeck did some very serious measurements, again by going to the ARRL archives. In this case, it is Ham Radio Magazine. He did a set of very serious measurements comparing 2, 3, 4, and 5 element Yagis to 2, 3, 4, and 5 element cubicle quads. And these were real serious DX guys in California that he was making these measurements. Let me drop. You read that series of articles by Dr. Wayne Oberbeck, and what he did was to take something like 100 feet of collapsible tower, mount it onto a trailer, tow it to various places in California where he was half a mile or 1 mile away from a big gun. He would have the big gun aim his antenna at him. In some cases it was a Yagi, in some cases it was a cubicle quad, and he made exact field strength measurements. Assembled all that data, if you go to the right article, and the bottom line of all that is he had great difficulty seeing any substantial difference in the performance of a well-constructed cubicle quad versus a well-constructed Yagi. When it comes to very small number of elements, like two elements, I think he discovered there was a slight performance improvement of quad versus Yagi. But when you got to four and five elements, cubicle quad and Yagi had the exact same gain. There were people I know, like the guy in Hempstead, who used to be on 432 in the mid-70s. I can't remember his call letters. WA2SDG is his call letters. Can't think of his name right now. He was a violin tuner, a real serious ham radio operator, VHF, UHF ham radio operator. He built something like an 18-element cubicle quad on 432 megacycles and did some comparison on a similar number of elements on Yagi construction, and there was no real improvement. He did find one slight advantage of quad over Yagi. Let me drop. And that is, when there was a whole lot of dew on the antenna, great big droplets of water early in the morning, the Yagi would detune itself with droplets of water near the tips of the Yagi elements. The extra capacitance of those great big drops of water hanging there would detune the antenna, and the cubicle rod did not suffer anywhere near as much from that detuning effect. However, we all discovered downrange that if you made the elements out of the Yagi elements out of 3/16 diameter aluminum rod or bigger on 432, even that effect disappeared. Eighth inch diameter rods would seriously suffer water detuning and ice detuning. 3/16 diameter rods for the elements on 432 did not. So except for that slight difference in weather performance, for four elements and above, they are essentially identical. And there's another good way of knowing about this. Let me drop. And that is Mr. Yagi on planet Earth, arguably, is Dr. Gunter Hawk, DL6W, Delta Lima 6, Whiskey Uniform. Dr. Gunter Hawk has spent a substantial portion of his lifetime studying the optimized Yagi antennas on essentially every single frequency where ham radio operators use them, everything from HF to high microwave frequencies. He would take every one known successful design, build a scale model of it on 432, assemble it into his great big anechoic chamber that was available to him at the German Federal Post Office in Darmstadt, Germany. The Federal Post Office Research Division is where he worked for a lot of years, and he would make measurements. And he's published a lot of articles in the UK, the Microwave Magazine in Germany. I'm having trouble thinking of the name of the magazine right now. Anyhow, the bottom line he came to is that once you've done a good job of tuning the directors, and you got approximately the right number of directors, the gain of a Yagi or the gain of a cubicle quad is strictly a function of the number of wavelengths of boom. It's opposite of common sense. As long as you've done a good job of putting approximately the right number of directors with approximately the right spacing, and when you tune it correctly, the main determinant of gain is the number of wavelengths of boom. This particular cubicle quad with four elements, I am guessing, is going to have a nominal gain of approximately 8 dB over isotropic, plus 8 dB over isotropic, which is very close to plus 6 dB over dipole, is the gain that you'll achieve. And I'm guessing it's going to have something in the vicinity of a 40 degree beam width, but I can do a better calculation on that. So this particular antenna is simple enough that unless you've made...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's simple enough that unless you've made some gross errors, it's going to give you 95% of the performance it's capable of. And if you're willing to do that last little bit of tuning, you can get a couple of more percent. But unless you're doing a very serious marginal moon bounce experiment, the guy you're talking to is never going to see the difference. These are my set of opinions on this one, though. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY, fine business. Okay, so we will recommend this antenna, and good luck with it. And as Dick and more or less elaborated on the construction, depends on whether you're going to keep it strictly portable or at home QCH. Looks like with a little beefing up, it will also provide you with a great antenna for the home QTH, very compact, and as Dick also said, in the last 8 years, the outlay for materials is very, very small, and the equipment needed really to make something like this is just basically maybe a hand drill and maybe a hacksaw or whatever, not much involved in putting this together. But the major, let me let it drop. The major really change that we both agree on is maybe is to use copper wire instead of aluminum wire, because as Dick elaborated, that's much easier to solder copper at the ends where they come together, where you have to make the connections for your coax and all. Everything is just easier to provide better connection is with copper. So, good luck with that. Thank you very much for your comments about TechNet from Virginia. And we'll continue, hopefully, with the TechNet now and pick up some more questions. Okay, Dick, go ahead. Because it's getting late, let's make sure we get everybody in here tonight. This is K2KEY.
As I look a little bit deeper, the way he used the aluminum rod was to bend it into circles where it came to the connection point, and then he put stakeons on the end of the shield and center conductor of his coax cable. He brought those stake guns over top of the loop of the on the end of the aluminum wire that was the drilling element. Then he put washers and screws to hold that all together. So it's a compression fitting, and that can work pretty well. You and I would think there's a little bit better performance you'll get out of soldering, because with that method of construction, the capacitive coupling at that point, because you're going to build up aluminum oxide and you're going to break contact someday, the capacitive coupling will give you most of the performance, but it might change a little bit. I'd rather have a real bond there, a real electronic bond, by way of soldering. Compression fittings with aluminum, it's a... If you're doing it at a high impedance point by way of a T connector or a folded dipole-like driven element, yes, you can work it. When you're at the driven element center conductor, that driven element right at the coax cable connection, where you're expecting 50 ohms and you would like any stray resistance there to be less than 50 milliohms, getting 50 milliohms with an aluminum compression fitting, in my opinion, is difficult, and to maintain it in the weather. Portable location where it's kept out of the weather most of the time, yeah, you'll get away with it. But for permanent, for a bunch of reasons, I would go over to copper. I think what they did in ARRL's handbook, let me drop, is they duplicated the original author's method of construction. He happened to use aluminum rod because that was available to him, and they didn't recommend any changes to the materials. But soldering it with copper is a much nicer way to go. You'll get a very slight change in the tuning of a cubicle quad as you change the diameter of the wire that makes up the elements. Where that came about, where that was first noticed, is that Wayne Overbeck, the K6YNB, the guy who invented the cubicle quad Yagi, he was recommending that you make the driven element of a cubicle quad, of this Yagi structure, quad for the reflector and driven element, and the rest of them were ordinary dipole directors. He recommended making that out of copper 14-gauge household wire. He recommended leaving the rubber on the wire in order to give you increased weatherproofing. When the ham radio operators in Germany, in Europe, started making the exact same antenna, because the wire that was available to them was metric-sized and not imperial dimensional size, and because the thickness of the rubber insulation and the exact material used for the rubber insulation available in Germany was different, the antenna ended up with a little bit of detuning, a little bit higher or low in frequency it ended up, the equivalent, even though they were using the exact same length, they had different diameters of materials, and ended up with a little bit of ISWA. Well, for the guys that were very serious about moon bounce, to them it was significant. To us, that's a minor factor. It's a very forgiving design. Okay, the next person on our list was Rich, N2EO. And what's going on in Whitestone tonight? N2, Echo Oscar, K2RIW on the TechNet. Maybe Rich got called away, and we'll go over to Joe next, WA2RYY. What's the latest with you, Joe? K2RIW on the TechNet.
Well, can you hear me okay in high band?
You're 80% noise, 20% audio. With earphones, I'm hearing you, but I'm not sure everyone else is going to get good copy, Joe. Go ahead.
Isaac, did I miss my turn? I had something to do until we go.
Yeah, we did give a call for you. And go ahead, Rich. N2EO, go right ahead.
Okay, Dick, I'm upstairs right now. Am I coming through on the HT, or you want me to go back downstairs?
You're 80% audio, 15% noise. I know that doesn't add up right. You sound good. Please proceed.
Okay, Dick, the cat was... the cat wanted some food and some attention, so I just walked away from the radio like 2 minutes ago. Dick, I got about another three weeks, I should have that kilowatt amplifier finished and running on 6 meters. To bring you up to date, I did use a pair of 3500Zs because Oh, well, my face is red. Remember I said I was getting 65 watts out? It turned out I had a bad jumper cable. One day I pulled on that cable and I saw the power come up to 100 watts on 6 and 2. So be that as it may, we have enough drive to drive a pair of 3500s. The SB200, it's a conversion article that was in, I believe, May 2008 QST. I have a reprint of the article. Everything is coming out very nice, but I have some questions dealing with the cosmetics, which is very important to me. There's a guy in the Midwest who's remaking SB220 panels. I bought one from him. He makes them in black instead of green. We drilled an extra hole and added a little toggle switch for a standby operate switch so we don't have to switch the amplifier power off to bypass. Let me drop. My question is, where the band switch was is now a input tune to the cathodes of the 3500Zs. What it consists of is an air variable 50 picofarad capacitor to ground, two coils making up a T network. And so that is going to say input tuning. And the numbers for 80, 40, 20, 15, 10 make no sense anymore because it's a 6-meter amplifier. Does anybody have any idea, or is it possible to get that white silk screen lettering off the paint, which is black, without destroying the new panel? What I was going to do was to have a sheet metal shop cut me up a plate and put it over the original, and I'll paint that first and letter it with dry transfers. But I thought this would maybe be a little bit neater. Back to net, N2EO. Maybe somebody has some experience with getting silkscreen letters off a panel.
And I think you said that was an SB220. And I'm looking at my SB220 right now. The tuning and loading controls are the first two knobs, the first two great big knobs. The third knob is the band switch knob. And in the lower right-hand corner, you've got your function switch and gain control for the reflected power measurement. So I think you're saying you want to switch those around, and therefore you're asking to remark that front panel. And you want to remove the white marking and come up with a new set of white markings because of your rearrangement of those knobs. Is that approximately what you're asking, Rich? Go ahead. N2EO, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, Dick. The what you see, band selection, 80, 40, 20, 15, 10, becomes an input tune. So I want to take those numbers off and re-letter it input tuning. The loading stays the same, and the plate tune has numbers on it, 80, 40, 20, 15, 10. I want to take those off. So I've seen people take lettering off a car. I don't know what they use to do that without destroying the lettering on the car, rather without destroying the actual face paint. Is it possible to get that off?
So you know how to do it.
Go right ahead, Bill.
Okay, been there, did it. All right. It's something that may be a little hard to find, but you may even have it. Years ago when we had regular typewriters, you remember them? Well, there was a thing called corrector type that you put it in, you typed over it. However, there was also typewriter erasers. One of the way the erasers came, it looked like a pencil. In fact, you sharpened it like a pencil, and in the center it had the eraser, the right eraser material, that you could actually erase. It had a slight bit of abrasive in it. If you remember the old typewriter races, Rich, I'm sure you do, they had a little abrasive in it that would, you know, just scrape off the lettering off the thing and give the paper a little bit of a sanding. but it took it off real well, and I found it does the same, did the same thing when I used it on a panel, Rich, over.
Now, let's see, was the lettering really sitting on top of the black paint on your brand new panel, Rich? It's not engraved into the panel? N2EO, K2RIW?
Silk screen.
No, it's not engraved. It's not like a concave. It's just silk screened. But it is a slight wrinkle finish. Is that gonna destroy the wrinkle finish, Mel?
You got it, Mel.
No, that's why I suggested this, because you can sharpen this to like a pencil. In other words, you can make it as sharp as you want to, this pencil eraser. And that way you can just be very careful, just work on the individual letters and not go across the panel, you know, horizontally or whatever, to remove the wrinkling. You want to just remove the letter as if you were actually scribing it yourself, Rich, over.
Okay, Mel, I thought somebody would come up with a good idea. Thank you. And Dick, to give you a rundown, I have another maybe 2 to 3 weeks. I should have that on the air. There's a lot of people now apparently doing these conversions of the, not the SP200, but the SP220 with the pair of 3500Zs. They work out very well on 6 meters. The article in QST said with 100 watts of drive, she'll put out about 1100 watts. So I think I'm going to be a happy camper. I'm coming out way ahead because I priced 6-meter amplifiers. There's not too many around. The only ones I know of are Steve K1FO at Lunarlink is over $3,000. And Command Technologies, which is now owned by PowerStar, has the same thing as Steve, a pair of 3CX800s, and that's also over $3,000. I estimate this thing to cost me about $1,000 to $1,200 to complete.
That's a very nice price. That's going to be $1,200 or less for you. Is that because you already owned an SB220? Or did you go to eBay and buy a used SB220 to begin this conversion process? Roughly where did you start this project with, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW?
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, N2EO. Well, I bought a basket case SB220 from Hal at Land Air Communications. It had, somebody had tried to put it on 160. The tank circuit was all ripped up, the front was repainted, no cabinets, and the tubes were missing. So the only thing that was really good that worked was the power supply. So, and of course the tube sockets were in there. I didn't have to do really too much chassis work. Right now it's holding me up. I'm waiting on some parts. Harbach Electronics, who specializes in a lot of aftermarket stuff for the SB220. We're adding a soft start startup to it, some other stuff, some new filter capacitors, which he's out of stock on. So this is going top shelf with a lot of new stuff is preventive maintenance. And I would say it's not going to go over 1,000, 1,200, 1,300 tops.
I know that you're making a modification so that you can go to 6 meters, and I think you're saying you'll have something like 1,100 watts output on 6 meters, which is some nice high power. Did you use used 3-500Zs? Because I think you said the tubes were missing. Is that part of the investment you had to make? And what bands will it finally be operational on when you're finished, Aaron? Rich, go ahead.
Strictly 6 meters. It's going to be strictly a 6-meter amplifier. And I bought a set of 3500s that had about 20 hours on them. They're IMAX. What did I pay for them now? They've gone up a lot. The pair cost me $200 a tube. $400 for a pair of almost new, in the box. These were used for 20 hours in some medical equipment and then put back in the box. And they're IMAX, and you can't get IMAX anymore because IMAX closed up their tube, their glass tube division. They only make the ceramic tubes now, so you got to go to the Amprex or to the Chinese tubes. So I was kind of lucky to get these at this price.
Very nice. And the nice thing about digital television over-the-air broadcast is that almost all of the channels 2 through 6 have been abandoned across the United States, with one exception. There is a low-power station now on what used to be channel 2, 54 to 60, called Daystar, which is a religious program. And
there's also channel 6, Dick.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. By the way, a couple of people mailed me emails confirming that channel 5-1 and 5-2 are two different RF frequencies. Channel 5.
Absolutely impossible.
They said 5-1 is on 44, channel 44. 5-2 is on channel 38.
Incorrect, and I'll tell you why.
So go right ahead, give us a couple words on that.
5-1 typically is WNYW TV. In that same stream is 5-2, which is WWOR. And the reason for this is Rupert Murdoch owns Channel 5, and he owns Channel 9, which is my TV. Okay? The RF carrier is determined by the primary or the major channel number, which is the 5. The dash 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, up to number 99 is actually a sub-channel within the stream. What it means is that there's a different packet number associated with it. 5-1 and 5-2 are all the same RF carrier. Equally, 9-1 and 9-2 are all the same carrier. 5-1 is channel 44. 5-2 is RF channel 44. 9-1 is channel 38. 9-2 is channel 38, RF-wise. Okay, and all you people out there that think that it's different, try go reading the ATSC A52 if you want to try and understand it.
Yeah, that's amazing, Eric, because a number of people wrote me emails confirming what I'm saying, saying something different than you. On top of that, on a number of occasions, because of propagation differences, I can get 5-1 and cannot get 5-2. And at a later time, I can get 5-2 and cannot get 5-1. I get the same characteristic between 9-1 and 9-2. It seems to be RF carrier frequency related. On top of that, there is a mode I can go to on a Radio Shack converter in which it tells you what RF frequency it is tuned to when you're on 5-1 and when you're on 5-2. And it tells me 5-1 is 44, and 5-2 is 38. So is Radio Shack wrong, and all those people that are mailing me wrong, and the fade out of the channels versus propagation, is that wrong also? Something very mysterious is happening here, Rich. I mean, Eric. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, you turned it over to me, Dick. I think you meant to turn it over to Eric.
Yes, I did. KE2EJ, sorry about that. Eric, go ahead and give us some more comments on that.
Yes, Dick, the world is wrong, okay? You come over to my place, I will put it on a stream analyzer for you. A stream analyzer would take apart the stream, okay? It can only be tuned to one channel, and I will show you 5-1 and 5-2. And then I will tune it to RF channel 38, and I will show you 9-1 and 9-2. And on 9-2, you will find WNYW, in standard definition, and in 5-2 I will show you WWOR in standard definition. Okay, I don't care what you say, it's wrong. And the fact that sometimes you can get 5-1 and not 5-2, okay, think about multipath or propagation issues where you're not capable of decoding the first part of the stream, but you can decode the second part of the stream, which actually makes no sense whatsoever. But if you're on the threshold, it actually does make some sense, and I can explain that to you.
Yeah, I accept that. Also, I've got another mode of operation in which I put the period first into the converter when I'm programming, when I'm commanding it, and I can command it to RF channel 44, and it comes up with 5-1. I can command it into RF channel 38, and it comes up with 5-2. My goodness, that converter is very confused. Okay.
All right, let me just tell you one more thing. And that is, the converter makes no decision about what the major number and the minor number is, okay? That information is contained inside the stream. There's something called PISIP, Program Information System Protocol, okay? And that's part of the header of any of the streams that are spit out, all right? The converter knows from nothing about 5-1, 5-2, 5-100, all right? That information is part of something called the TVCP, or the television channel table, all right? I can make your converter say that it's channel 99 if I want the converter to say it's channel 99. The converter itself, or any of the receivers, cannot, will not, tell you what the major channel number is on its own. It has to be told.
Okay. When I command it to RF channel 44, and it tells me 5-1. Is that because 5-1 was stuck into that slot of the memory of the converter? Or is it telling me 5-1 because it is reading the header on the RF information it is decoding? Over to you, Eric.
Actually, it depends on the converter, okay? Sometimes the converter will only pick up, depending upon what the converter is and who made it. Many converters, when you do a scan, it fills up the channel table in the converter, and that's where it stays. Whether or not your things actually change is not necessarily reflected as far as what the converter channel says. In some of the later receivers, because of some of the inconsistencies in the whole PISIP process, they've decided that, well, we're going to ignore what's in there, and we'll basically take what the stream has gone through it at this particular moment in time. For example, there are times when you don't see the guide. And actually, the guide's there. You've complained about the guide not being there, but the guide is actually there. But there's a little bit of information that happens before the guide called the PMT, or the Program Management Table, and it had a little something wrong with it. Your converter decided, I'm not reading anything, or I'm not reading anything. Therefore, you got no guide. So there's a lot of complexities in this, and it's not just as simple as thinking that an RF channel is associated with a major channel number and a minor channel number. The reason for the PISIP, let me get it dropped, at the time that we were doing simulcasting between analog and digital, it was decided that branding, you know channel 4 as channel 4. Channel 4 is not on channel 4. Channel 4 is on channel 28. Okay, but as far as the converter is concerned, it says it's channel 4. Something has to tell it that. And that's the information in the PSIP. And the reason for that was to maintain the branding. So when you had the analog, you tuned to channel 4, which was actually, let's see, that was 6125. And when you tuned to digital channel 4, it was actually 513, I forget what the actual RF frequency is. But those are two different RF frequencies, but yet they identified them the same. K2RW, K2J.
Interesting. A little more research is required here. I have a little bit of skepticism yet, but I'm beginning to believe you, Eric.
Go to the ATSC website if you want all the information. The protocol is right there. ATSC.org, AlphaTangoSierraCharlie.org. Look at Alpha 52. It's there for you to read. It'll take you a while to read it, but every little bit of information, how the protocol works and how it's in there. There's no mystery here. This is just the reality of it. Believe me.
BB2AZQ.
That's AZQ. And you're on this subject, go right ahead. Start off with your name, sir.
Okay. Hey, it's Tom here, and I was curious with your conversation. I got a Zenith converter, and I too can put an RF channel in, and I was as surprised too. I dialed up RF channel 44. I can get 5-1.